I wish I had learned this when I was in college, because when I went into the Wall Street world, I did not quite understand how do I act under pressure, which means I was spending half my time doing my job and half my time worrying about my job. What's the implication? I wasn't full on board capable. I was too busy worrying about, oh my God, what's going to happen if?
It's not often I get to sit in the studio with a college professor, someone who had a top position in a Fortune 500 company, and many other aspects. It's none other than Chuck Garcia. And we're going to be talking about emotional intelligence. IQ? Everyone heard of IQ. What's my IQ score? But wait a second. What's emotional intelligence? EQ, and how that can make your career soar. Chuck, a treat to have you back in the studio here. First of all, thank you.
Thank you for having me back, Yitzhak. I feel very at home in your studio, and thank you for having me.
Now, this relationship is now 8 years?
Indeed. You were
John McLaughlin.
And always a shout out to John. When my book, A Climb to the Top, my first book was released in May of 2016, you did an act of kindness and a solid for me that I will never forget and that I strive to repay. It was the day my book was released, I came onto your show, and I cannot thank you enough and your team for just being such a wonderful partner in my journey and for the honor of being able to talk about A Climb to the Top at the release on your show. I'm grateful for that.
It's a very special relationship.
Indeed.
Yeah. And again, a special thank you to John McLaughlin.
No
he
question.
Nailed it.
You know? He is a great connector.
He's a great
John,
connector.
Credit to you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Now, last we spoke was a year ago, and it was before the release of Now, which I'm holding. And by the way, thank you. Of course, me and Michal were treated to a personalized copy. Of course, you know how special that means to us.
Thank you.
The moment that defines your life in integrating emotional intelligence and stoicism when your life, career, and family are on the line. This was released, and for the people that signed up early, they got the digital version and then the physical version. Talk about since last year that journey, and now it's out there. It's in bookstores. Talk about the journey.
When I thought about how am I going to follow up A Climb to the Top? And for the listeners or now viewers that don't know me, my first book, A Climb to the Top, uses mountaineering as a metaphor for how to career climb. But as a mountaineer, I relied on ice axes and crampons to climb. But instead, the metaphor serves that we use communication skills by which we climb our career mountains. What I found, Yitzhak, in my coaching practice and in my teaching at Columbia University, I was teaching people to communicate, but there were a couple instances where I was finding my methods are not landing. Something is not working. I am trying to help someone with the communication tactics that I outline in my book, which is called, biblically, the Ten Commandments of Great Communicators. And it really culminates in, what did I learn as a public spokesman for many years for Bloomberg, and what did I learn from the very best communicators? But here's where there was a disconnect. As I was teaching people these methods, every now and then, somebody was just not, it wasn't resonating. And at first I wondered, all right, is it him, her, me? Where is the disconnect? And I subsequently came to find out that for some of those cases, it wasn't that they weren't adopting the tactics that I was teaching. I subsequently found out that the reason they don't seem to be advancing is because they're scared to death. And I didn't quite appreciate, what is it the fear that we're trying to address when people are communicating? And I never really thought about that until I hit a case where I need to solve this problem. So I said, and I went home scratching my head, how am I going to solve this problem? And if I solve one problem, could this be applicable to other people that are feeling the same?
Mm-hmm.
And what I found, Yitzhak, is upon trying to uncover what is happening, people started to talk through the lens of their fears. Okay, what are you afraid of? I'm afraid of judgment. I'm afraid of making a mistake. I'm afraid of falling flat on my face. And my point to them, particularly in the executive world where I coach, I said, well, you hired me for a purpose. Yeah, but if you don't help me to remove my fears, you could teach me all day long. It's not going to help. So what that did, Yitzhak, it led to, in my mind and in my heart, I started to develop a different method away from simply the communication skills that had to augment. How do I help someone to become a more compelling communicator? Mm-hmm. Now, what I found is through the years, I had learned this social science called emotional intelligence. And the old adage, once taught, twice learned. When I started to teach emotional intelligence, I began to see the tie to communications. That the more that I could help somebody identify, measure, and monitor their emotional intelligence, which is driven by mostly by self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of the fear? How do we help you remove it? Because some people are not aware that they're afraid. They just act afraid and don't know how to label it. So we needed to put some kind of moniker on this problem we're trying to solve. And it came down to emotional intelligence, which is the first part of the book. But here's where it changed, Yitzhak. Since the 1990s, when emotional intelligence was invented, so to speak, as modern social science, by a guy named Daniel Goleman, a Harvard psychologist, writes this book called Emotional Intelligence, Why EQ is More Important Than IQ. It's like, okay, that's catchy. All right, what is this thing?
Right.
As I was learning EQ, I said, all right, there's a million EQ books out there. If I'm going to write about this, I need to write about how EQ manifested in the context of how I used it. Mm-hmm. And what I found is I started to help people improve when I integrated it with this philosophy that seemed foreign to me. Particularly when I was in college and people talked about this philosophy called Stoicism, I was completely ignorant to it, or I was too dim-witted to understand it. But when people talked about philosophy, it seemed unreachable, out of touch. I didn't know what they were talking about. But this concept of Stoicism, the recognition that I am not what happened to me, any event that occurs in your life, it's really driven by how I choose to perceive that event. And this is where, now I'll get to the heart of the question. The moment that defines your life was driven by my desire to write a book on emotional intelligence, but to integrate it with the philosophy in a way that no one had written before, because it was unique to me, to how it is I helped my students and the people that hired me to coach them. So the book was really driven by, or at least the title, what we know in our lives is our days, our months, our weeks, and our moments are not equally weighted. You could go about for 10 years and nothing happens, or you could have a lifetime happen in 2 weeks. We don't know. That's unpredictable.
Right.
Some people even say sometimes weeks happen in decades, sometimes decades happen in weeks. So what I found, Yitzhak, is that how am I going to write this book? When I started to reach out to my world with the idea to write this book, what everyone was talking about that was near and dear to my heart is a lot of what they learned about themselves, what they learned about the world, what they learned about others was driven by a moment.
Right.
Now, in my case, something you and I talked about when I came on your show years ago is my moment. I had a couple moments, but on 9/11, we won't get into that, but on 9/11, I was on a dead list for 4 hours. And something happens to your psyche when you're unaccounted for and presumed dead, and I was one of them. That was a moment. The moment when I saw my name on a list, presumed dead, I could not imagine if my wife and my children saw my name on that list, that is a moment. So what I decided to do, I'm going to write this book, and I'm going to use narratives of other people that had moments, including my own, because I think I needed to establish credibility that I might know what I'm talking about. And the common thread between the narratives were integrating how we helped work through our issues, our problems, challenges, obstacles, whatever you may call them. Formal education did not teach us how to get through that. But what I learned over time, if we can integrate the social science of emotional intelligence, with a mindset, a philosophy, the way that we pursue and approach different circumstances in our lives, maybe we're onto something. So that the book is a series of stories about a lot of people from many walks of life, where I, in the narration of the story, talk about their story arc, the moment that climaxed, and really help them recognize something about themselves and how I applied the tools of emotional intelligence and the philosophy of stoicism to put their story in perspective and to help the reader understand that one day this may be you. Don't go it alone. Here are prescriptions. Here is a perspective of how I can help you deal with it.
Now, before we go back to the script, okay, there's something that I just would love to reflect on, because I'm always impressed when someone is so cued in that they are self-aware. You had brought up that, and correctly so, that like you're teaching and like, is it really resonating? Now, there are many people out there like, I taught it. They should be getting it. Mm. If, why aren't they concentrating? Meaning it's their fault. It's their fault. But you said, well, wait a second. Maybe I could be doing something differently. How important, before we even go back to the script and EQ, how important is it for someone to be mindful and self-aware? Maybe it's me, not them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for posing that, but I think it's well true. Worth going deep, Yitzhak. And I want to put this into perspective of how I simply came to be self-aware. I work for a guy named Mike Bloomberg, who we all know. And I learned a lot from him, but I think when I reflect on what I learned most, Mike was always the one saying, he's talking about himself. I am accountable for whatever anyone in this organization does. He taught us the importance of holding ourselves accountable, and he led by example, because no matter what was happening, he wanted to take accountability, but to those who were given much, much is expected. He held us accountable and he expected us to adopt the same ethos of accountability. So when you think about, before we even get into the concept of self-awareness and what I had to examine to become a better teacher, I left the Bloomberg world and ultimately now in coaching and teaching at Columbia, I bring that same mindset of accountability. It's me. If there's something going on here, the first thing that I have to examine if it's not working, I have to be accountable to solve the problem. I cannot assume that this was driven by somebody else. Now, maybe it was, but it's not my starting point, and that's what I learned from him. So when I started to teach, there were many people who were adopting my methods, and they were amazing. They could teach my methods. But when somebody wasn't, what I learned from Mike is before we go and point fingers and start saying, hey, it's your problem, it's not. It's my problem first. And where I started to develop that concept of becoming self-aware started with who is accountable to solve this problem? Me. Okay, how do I solve it? Well, it starts with self-examination. And the four pillars of emotional intelligence mm-hmm. are self-awareness, social awareness, the capacity to read a room, self-management, and relationship management. What I'm describing is where it begins. Was I sufficiently self-aware to take the energy I had for examination and start with the self? And this is why I wrote the book, Yitzhak, because when I thought about that concept of the philosophy of Stoicism, it talks about the self, not in a selfish way, to the mm-hmm. contrary, mm-hmm. that the accountability okay. begins here. Once we examine the self, only then should we give ourselves permission to examine the other. So to your point, what you picked up on as I was struggling to figure out how to solve a problem, it had to start with me. Now, that doesn't say that the person I'm working with isn't equally accountable, but I think when it comes to accountability, it's not evenly allocated. Everybody has a different idea. Oh, it's his fault. I'm going to blame the world. I lost the election because, okay. Maybe. I don't think that way. I have a responsibility to the people in my charge to okay. teach them. And if they are not learning, It's not that they don't get it. It would be easy for me to write that off. I'm just not going to let that go. So the self-awareness, amazing, the pillar of emotional intelligence, it has to start there, because the philosophy of Stoicism says there's only one thing on this planet that I can control. It's not my spouse. It's not my kids. It's not my job. It's me, my behavior, and my sense of accountability. And that's what the self-awareness is.
We're speaking with Chuck Garcia, noted professor, mountain climber, and author, and his new release, his latest release, The Moment That Defines Your Life. By the way, what are the recommended methods for someone picking up the book?
The book is available in several places, but obviously you can get it in on Amazon.com, and you can get it in hardcover, you can get it in Kindle. You can go to Barnes & Noble, to Thrift Books. There is no lack of ways to get it. You can also go to my website, chuckgarcia.com, where I describe both The Moment and my first book, A Climb to the Top, and where to get them. Real easy in the modern world.
Now, Chuck, the world of EQ, as you mentioned, it's not new in concept, but in the early 90s is when someone said, aha, there was that aha moment. Mm-hmm. IQ, everyone recognized, you could take a test, but wait a second, there's emotions. Mm. In fact, maybe we could even open this part of the conversation up with the quote from Maya Angelou, because isn't that a foundational mindset of EQ?
It is. In fact, I want to share that and then integrate it with something from EQ, the book Emotional Intelligence. And what Yitzhak is referring to, the best advice I have ever received was not from a business person. It was from a poet and activist, the late, great Maya Angelou. And I remember I listened to her, and I remember somebody said to her, what's the one piece of advice that you would give to us sitting in this audience? And she said that people will forget what I said, people will forget what I did, but they will never, and you heard a pause for dramatic effect, forget how I made them feel. And what she talked about was the power of the interaction. What happens when you meet someone? What happened when I walked into the door to your studio? I'm not walking in here tactically thinking, oh, I just got another hour I got to do. There is a feeling of emotion that guides my energy and helps me to determine how to allocate it toward the people in my life that are important. And when Maya said that, I was like, wow, huh. You know what? I thought about every interaction I've ever had. Right. What do I remember about my closest friends is how they make me feel. They're welcoming, they're inviting, they're open-minded, they're talking, they're listening. It's a feeling. It has nothing to do with the mind and everything to do with the heart. Yet, what do we learn in school? It's all mind. Not that the heart is devoid of it, it's just we're not tested for it.
Right.
But we are tested for it in every interaction. You and I as business people, we have clients. Right. How do they feel about us?
Right.
There's a million people who do what you and I do.
Right.
So why are you and I hired?
Right.
Well, we're accountable, but also I'd like to think that when people work with us, they feel good and fulfilled.
Absolutely.
That is never to be underestimated. And then, Yitzhak, when I started to read this book, Emotional Intelligence, there was a quote right from the beginning of the book that really struck me. And it was said this: CEOs are hired for their intellect and expertise, pause for dramatic effect, and fired for their lack of emotional intelligence. What happened in the 90s, as you and I know, is the social fabric started to change. The internet was in play, so everything was on display. If you said something that was offensive, you were going to be on Twitter in 5 seconds. How dare you say that? That all of a sudden, there was a heightened consciousness to how we behave. But particularly to people who run companies are very visible.
Yeah.
And so while they may be hired for their experience, the world was no longer going to let them get away with their offensive behavior.
Right.
That was no longer tolerable. Now, when I grew up in the Wall Street world in the 80s, nobody paid a lick of attention to our behavior. People got away, and I cringe often over what I heard one person say to another and couldn't believe that everybody just shrugged it off. Oh, that's business. We do not live in that world any longer.
Right.
Everything we say is under examination.
Right.
It's under a microscope.
It's out there.
Well, so what does that mean? That means that we, CEOs, you, me, We are all accountable for our behavior in ways that a generation ago didn't seem to matter. And I think that, Yitzhak, is the fabric of EQ and Stoicism. If we expect to succeed in the world, there are other factors that are going to drive people's capacity to want to follow us as leaders. Leadership and followership is not about, hey, follow Chuck, he's your boss. Okay, that's compliance. But what you and I, what we've talked about often is, who are the people that we admire? The people that we choose to follow. In my case, it's the ones that make me feel good about following them.
Right.
And I'd like to think that if somebody's going to follow me, I'm going to give them a reason, a fulfilling experience, a circumstance that's going to make them feel, this is someone I want to follow. And that's what I try to express in the book, that half of what we do is behave, maybe more than half, but our behavior is always on display. Our intellect, sometimes as needed, but we never are far from the capacity to treat someone with kindness and respect. And yet, how often do we not see that? Well, maybe it's something that needs to be taught. And what I learned over the years, Yitzhak, all of this that I described in The Moment That Defines Your Life is learned behaviors. In fact, I will even say, when I consider my formal education, the books that I wrote are the books that I wish I had read when I was in college. And that's part of why I read it. I was like, why did not somebody tell us about this stuff? We crammed, we examined, and we regurgitated. Where did that have to do with how we make somebody feel? So you see the disconnect?
It's great. Now, Chuck, let's talk about applying this to the team, mm-hmm. right? So there are teams, there's an expression, a team of one. Okay, we know a team needs more than one. Okay, great.
Yeah.
But small teams, medium-sized teams, they're teams that, remember, companies that have 100 employees, have a staff of 500, they started off with a dream and may have been 5 people, 10 people. What are some tips and tricks from your experience, and you have clients that you coach and teams that you coach that in order to make sure that the goals, the vision, they're aligned, they're communicating with each other.
Yeah. Well, it starts with, let's look at the demand from the employers and what they seek in their talent. You and I are active on LinkedIn, Yitzhak. Yeah. And every year LinkedIn publishes 2 lists that I'm keen to review. One of them for my Columbia engineers, what are the STEM subjects most in demand? And right now, artificial intelligence, blockchain technology, cloud computing, those things you would expect, that they appear on more job ads on LinkedIn than any others. Okay, but what do I do for a living? Leadership competencies. And they do publish the other list, which are the top 10 soft skills that appear on more job ads than any other. And invariably, emotional intelligence is number 5 on that list. Thank God. That's really good. Communication is number 1. No surprise. But what's number 3? Teamwork and collaboration. Mm. So the first thing that we can acknowledge is companies are actively telling their prospective employees this matters. Why does it matter? In all my years on Wall Street, what every CEO was trying to figure out, how do we as an organization, recognizing all of us is better than any one of us, how do we maximize productivity?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know it in sports because it's on display.
Right.
We watch a football or soccer team and we know the good teams from the disconnected teams. The tough part about an organization, we're not on display on TV. It all happens somehow invisibly, but it has to happen. What I have found in this executive world, and I coach many companies, a lot in the financial sector, tech sector mostly, because that's where my pedigree lies. What I find is the frustration from the people that hire me. How do I get people to work better together? And then it goes back to the self-awareness, Yitzhak, and we have to ask ourselves, why? We can't assume, oh, they don't work together because they're different race, creed, color. It has nothing to do with that. Well, maybe a touch, but for the most part, people come into companies. When it comes to technical competence, let's just say that everyone is pretty close on the same plane. They're pretty good at what they do. And while they're learning to do it better, but where does the frustration lie? when they are asked to do something with someone else. What happens? Breakdown in communication. It's the old adage, I know what I said, now tell me what you heard. And invariably, I said red and you heard blue. How could that be? And many of us, when we give an instruction to 10 people and we find that 6 follow it, 2 do it beyond expectation, and 2 aren't even close. But we asked you to do the same. It's baffling, is it not? Until I figured out, oh my God, what is happening here? I use an exercise to help solve this problem, which is called the 4 compass points. I want everyone to think about when you are assigned a task, there is a default, and there are 4 defaults that occur to any human being when it comes to the task. And I use it in the metaphor of a compass because I put it in terms of north, south, east, and west. Mm-hmm. So I want you to consider in your mind, if you were given a task to do, recognizing you're going to do it with other people, if you are the kind of person that jumps in, yeah, let's go, you are in the north. You are a let's do it, forget the details. If you are in the east, you like the big picture. You want to say, hey, what are we doing here? I want to know, what is the end in mind? What is it we're actually trying to do before we begin? Whereas the people in the north said, it doesn't matter, let's just begin. Right. If you are on the west, you're the detail-oriented individual. I want details. I cross my T's, I dot my I's. This isn't happening until I know all the details. And if you were in the south, your default setting is you are the harmonizer. Yeah, it's one thing to have the details. Yeah, you need the big picture. But I'm the guy that makes everybody feel better. And we need that. So what I do in this exercise is revealing. Because for the first time in many companies' history, we're actually taking the time to look at the room when I ask everyone, go to your compass point. And what happens, Yitzhak, if we were a helicopter hovering above, you're seeing 4 people go to any one of 4 corners. It is striking when everyone gets to their corner and you're looking around. Oh my God, I had no idea you thought that way. Yes, I'm a detail-oriented individual. I'm not being difficult because I'm trying to sideline the project. I need details. That's why you thought I was a jerk. I wasn't. What is happening here, Yitzhak? We're now beginning to understand, even if just a slight opening, oh my God, our operating styles are different. Right. Well, right. We may think they're different, but now we're putting a science to it. We're not just saying that our operating styles are different. We're identifying them. We're acknowledging them. We're letting people know, yeah, this is your default setting. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're in the north and you're given a project and you're accountable for that project and you're working with someone in the south, best we know what we're getting into. No different than a marriage, a best friend. EQ is a method by which we understand ourselves, we begin to understand others, and we have an operating style by which we can say, oh my God, this is revelatory. Now I understand. Wow. Now I know why you were so picky on that project. I understand you. I see you. I get you. I hear you. I understand you. That is what's missing in the corporate world because we're not intentional about it. We just give them a project, hope for the best. Some do fine, some do not. I think that bar is too low. Yeah. I think we should apply the same methods of self-examination that we started on this episode with you. We went deep on self-awareness. Let's go deep on the team. Teams need to be self-aware. I know sports teams actually do have psychologists. They have guys like me that help everybody understand, hey, guys, how are we going to row in the same boat?
Right.
The corporate world, it looks at this sometimes as frivolous. Not my clients. The ones that hire me, oh my God, God knows we need this. It's not only refreshing, it's useful, it's practical, and now people are beginning to talk to each other about it. Hey, this is great. We're talking about our feelings. Corporate America isn't supposed to talk about their feelings. Says who? In 2024, best that we acknowledge that we feel first and we think second. When I grew up in the 80s, it was think first, feel never.
You know, Chuck, for the people that are fortunate enough to hire you, and especially the corporate world, it's fascinating. Maybe this is part, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, maybe why we connected and bonded so well. Yeah. You're taking your, how many years are you at Bloomberg?
14.
14 years at one of the top Fortune 500 companies.
Indeed.
Okay.
Great company.
And you answered to Mike, you were in that sphere.
I was in his sphere, no doubt.
In that sphere. And of course, as a professor, so understanding that world as well. Okay. And of course, as an author and as a speaker, for those that are saying to themselves, wow, how can I get a hold of this guy? Okay. What's the best way?
thank you for highlighting that. But to anyone, if I can be of assistance to you, if you remember my name, Chuck Garcia, make it one word and add a .com. The good news is when you get to my homepage, on the top right-hand corner of that page is a big blue button, and it says the word contact. It's really easy. All you have to do is hit it. Give me your name. I'll be back to you within a day.
And he's very approachable. I just want to say, even though with all his credentials, he's very approachable.
I appreciate that. Try to be. Try to be humble and kind always.
Thank you. It's true. Okay, now we're going to get to a delicate topic that you dive right in and discuss in the moment that defines your life. Yeah. Okay. Unpredictability. Yeah. Okay, now, let's talk about the mental model. You spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
How we can turn unprecedented moments, challenges, uncharted waters, even in times of chaos, into a learning experience, a positive experience, something that I could take and grow from it instead of crumble through it.
Yeah. I want to put this in a Wall Street type term that I hope everyone can understand. When we think about the world's greatest investors and those that I learned from, in addition to Mike Bloomberg, I've read everything that Warren Buffett and his partner, God rest his soul, Charlie Munger, ever. I read everything that anyone has written about them. I read everything that they've ever written, not because they are such great investors and worth $115 billion. I don't care about that. But Charlie Munger was, and Warren Buffett is, they're very kind people who give really sound advice. But I remember when Charlie Munger was talking about his evolution at Berkshire Hathaway and what he talked about the individual career ascent. He talked about the importance of the development of what he calls mental models. And we use sometimes in terms of mental tools, but think about this word, mental model. What does that mean? Well, what Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger talk about is they want everyone to recognize that we are the sum of three mental circles. Our circle of competence, this thing that we do,
right.
And their encouragement is to go deep in your circle of competence. Don't work outside of it. There's plenty to do to stay in your circle of competence, be known as the best plumber in Brooklyn. If that's what you want to be known as, don't go to Manhattan, don't go to Queens. That is your circle of competence. Second circle, circle of dignity. What is not negotiable to you? That's how I know who you are, by what you are not willing to tolerate. Circle of dignity. And then the third one is the circle of trust. Who's in your circle? So what Buffett and Munger often talked about is anytime there is a circumstance, there is a decision to be made, mostly in the decision model. Mm-hmm. Walk through your circles. Is what I'm doing is what somebody's asking me to do in my circle of competence? Is what somebody's asking me to do, does it not betray my circle of dignity? It has to be something that is consistent with my ethos. And then third, who am I going to do this with? That is the circle of trust. That's a tight circle. So mm-hmm. We have thousands of followers, you and I. I'd like to think they're my friends, but they're not. Many of them I barely know, but I do know who my friends are, and I will do anything for them as they would for me. So we begin with the models that everything that we approach could fit into a mental model. Okay, then what? Well, circumstances happen that are unpredictable. Many of us have lived lives where we'd like to think that we can predict what's going to happen, but even in the U.S. political scene, in the last 3 weeks, we have lived decades. Yes, so much has happened, and in our personal lives, it's not that different. Sometimes not a lot happens for a couple of years, and all of a sudden, babies are born, people die, things all happen in sequence. So where does the moment that defines your life fit in? What I talk about to the reader is the encouragement that it begins with the development of the mental models. And part of the mental models is recognizing this philosophy of Stoicism has its own mental models. And when it talks about what Marcus Aurelius in his book Meditations that inspired me to write the book talked about the mental models of Stoicism, justice, courage, wisdom, and the fourth one really got me, temperance. So the mental model, what really speaks to me is temperance, because I think that is the X factor in all individuals. Are they calm under the weight of pressure and expectations? Take two people, give them the same situation. One of them could be calm, grace under fire, and deliver above expectations. Somebody else of equal intellect, of the same education, crushed under the weight of that pressure. The philosophy and the mental models help us recognize that the majority of things that happen to us are unpredictable, and that what I hope to encourage in the book is that you develop a set of guiding principles, a set of tools that make you unique. But instead of trying to invent those tools, it was invented thousands of years ago in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, where we just simply bring their ancient philosophy into a modern context. So what happens when the world, so the sky starts falling? Some people are going to panic and scream and run. I go through the mental models. Okay, what's happening here? How do I stay calm? What is the problem I'm going to try to solve? Because if I just go off without any kind of forethought, that sky's going to fall on me. So instead, it starts with me. What can I do to solve this problem? I know if I stay calm, I got a shot at doing it. What am I suggesting, Yitzhak? That this philosophy that I'm talking about is conscious and intentional. Recognizing the circumstances beyond my control, okay, not much I can do about it. What can I do about it? It's how I choose to react. And I'm using that word choose. Every one of us, take 10 people in a room and put their feet under fire. We're all going to react differently.
Right.
So I wish I had learned this when I was in college, because when I went into the Wall Street world, I did not quite understand how do I act under pressure, which means I was spending half my time doing my job and half my time worrying about my job. What's the implication? I wasn't full on board capable. I was too busy worrying about, oh my God, what's going to happen if? I was not nearly as productive as I should have been until I figured out, oh my God. And this is what I like. We learned also from Mike Bloomberg about being fully productive, about being present. All right, you screwed up. You made a mistake. Get it out of your head. And he was good about that. Just fix it and move on. Clear your mind. He used to say that. All right, no worries. What's your next move? You can't do it if your mind is jumbled. So don't worry about it. This is where I learned. In that corporate world, I learned from him because I saw the way that he behaved and I saw how he led by example. Clear the mind. Wow. You mean I'm not in trouble? Don't worry about that, because if you think about that, you're wasting your time. So it was the development, my confidence, my self-confidence started to soar in my career when I started to stop thinking about what could have happened, what would have happened, what should have happened, unproductive thoughts. We want to be able to everything that we approach, clear? Is it, even when I think about how we communicate, is it clear? Is it concise? And is it purposeful? So now everything I approach is in the frame of, I need to be clear, I need to be concise, and I need to be purposeful. Another mental model. We ask ourselves and we communicate. So that's Yitzhak. There are many ways to apply these models, but I think the behavioral model of this temperance, how do I temper that anger? How do I channel the fear into something productive? God, I wish someone had taught me that. And I hope now to be the teacher to others where they may not have learned that themselves.
Now, aside from the fact that you are a professional coach, for those that just, I don't say quick fix, because they should be intentional about it, they can get it through the book. Yeah. The book, The Moment That Defines Your Life. What's the best way people can pick up the book?
Yeah, bestly. Since most people live on Amazon anyway, if you go to Amazon.com, there's a couple ways of doing this. You remember my name from this broadcast, Chuck Garcia. You can type it in, and lo and behold, you'll also get another book called The Climb to the Top. Or you could just type in The Moment That Defines Your Life. You could even Google it. Or go to chuckgarcia.com. There is a tab, the book tab, on chuckgarcia.com, and you can just click it. And it is available in audio form if you'd rather listen. Plenty of people said they want to listen, so I went into a studio on 52nd Street, spent 2 days recording the audiobook. It was a lot of fun.
Wow.
But people do like to listen. They want to download it in the modern world. I underestimated the amount of people that want to actually listen to my voice. I'm like, all right, bring it on. But thank you. So there are, and then Kindle. There are all forms are available.
Okay. Now let's get to, there's still so much we got to get to. And, you know, when I have someone of your stature in the studio, it's exciting. It's exciting. Around 8 years ago, someone by the name of Chuck Garcia taught me how to pronounce Mount Kilimanjaro. Right. I couldn't pronounce it beforehand. Now, but more importantly is the fact where, and I would like to take the audience back to that spot 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And it hit me like a ton of bricks. There's textbook teaching. Great. You could teach someone like, oh, you know, climbing the top of the mountain is such a great metaphor. And you could see the
you
world.
You too.
Hey, it's great. And, and then there's, wait a second, students, class, followers, we're going to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. And like you said in the last show, I say, what's the most important aspect? I said, getting to the top. You said, no, getting back down.
Getting home.
So let's talk about the importance of teaching, which is very nice, you know, textbook and doing, clamping on that full gear and climbing and, oh my, life's on the line if you make a mistake.
Yeah, I want to put it in the metaphor, Yitzhak. What we are talking about here is what many of the educators call experiential learning. Some call it active learning, but to me, experiential learning is not doing something in a classroom. While there are exercises you can do for experiential learning, the mountaineer in me wanted to bring not only my love and my passion for the mountains because it taught me so much about life, I wanted to bring that same level of enthusiasm to my students. But before I did that, I wanted to communicate to them, for those who have never climbed a mountain, that when I was on Mount Kilimanjaro, it hit me when we finished that mountain. Oh my God. This entire trip was a metaphor for how I climbed my career. And what I thought about it, I developed a mental model that had three things in common with my career. Number one, set a goal. Now, what I said to you, my goal was not to get to the summit. My goal was to get home to my family. Because the summit is optional, getting home is mandatory. The second part, after you set your goal, now the method. How do you get there? One step at a time. Now, think about the metaphor in business. There's no shortcuts to the top.
That's right. It's just
not going to happen. Achievements are done with small steps over a long period of time. So set a goal, one step at a time. And then the most important, Yitzhak, to me, and that's really where I derive the meaning, you can't do it alone. Right. You cannot climb a mountain by yourself. It's just not possible. You could, but that's imprudent.
Yeah.
When we climb careers, I could not have done it alone. I had wonderful mentors. I made a lot of friends. We helped each other. We worked with each other. That is how you climb a mountain. So what I decided when I started teaching, I'm going to bring my students, and I have climbed, I'm going to say probably 11 mountains with my students.
Wow.
We've done 7 of them. We've done in New York State's highest mountain called Mount Marcy. I've taken my students 6 times to New Hampshire's highest peak called Mount Washington, which is 6,000 feet above sea level. We wake up at 4:30 in the morning. Can you imagine getting a bunch of 18-year-olds to wake up at 4:30? I was a little concerned, but I cracked a whip. It's not negotiable. That bus leaves at 6 a.m. If at 6:01 you're complaining you missed the bus, we're not coming back to get you. Why did I do that? To hold them accountable that if you're 5 minutes early, you're 10 minutes late. That was the very first lesson in mountaineering. The bus leaves and you're not on it. I don't want to hear your excuses. So there were so many life lessons from the time that we got into a vehicle to get us to the mountain toward what happened in the climb to the summit. The most important part, some people have good days, some don't. The people that are having a good day help the others, that we all get to the top together. All of us is better than any one of us. That is mountaineering. That is bottom line marketing. That is client leadership. But I think that's an important thing because 100%. You have a wonderful staff here. They support the mission.
Thank you.
Well, this is culture. And you lead by example with your enthusiasm and your caring. I try to do the same. That is why mountaineering is so important to me, to bring my students out on the mountain and let them see some days you're going to freeze. It's cold and you're going to be hungry and you're going to be tired. But that does not let you off the hook to be accountable. And part of why I did it, Yitzhak, I saw in school, everyone wanted everyone to be comfortable. Okay. I want them to be uncomfortable, because when you go into this Wall Street world I grew up in, it gave new meaning to the word discomfort.
Right.
Because I'm surrounded by strangers who couldn't care less about me. And when you're on the mountain, the rain and the snow and the sleet doesn't care a lick about me. What do? We have to adjust to the unpredictable. That's a learned behavior. If we only read about it, we will never live it. So part of my burning desire to bring my students or anybody, I've done it once at the corporate level, to bring them onto the mountain and let them feel how hard it is. But the best part, when all is said and done and you're soaking your feet in a tub of hot water, you're recognizing it was worth it, because this is where the growth occurs. It doesn't occur in the ease. The growth occurs in the struggle. And mountain climbing is a struggle, as all careers are struggles.
Now, coming back to something we touched on earlier in our conversation, converting moments into opportunities, and you have an amazing approach here in the book, The Moment That Defines Your Life. Mm-hmm. Perception, action, will. Please break that out.
Yeah, well, that is a Stoic philosophy where if you take a situation with 10 of us and you ask us to perceive it, it's really fascinating to see how different we see that circumstance by a different perception, because we bring a different lens. You, Yitzhak, grew up in a community that helped you form a perspective. I grew up on a military reservation of a civilian father, of an academic father, and my mother was a pianist. So I grew up to the sounds of language and music. So everything to me, I see through the lens of these things that have formed me. That's the perception, which means when a circumstance occurs, it is not fair to think that you and I are going to perceive that situation as the same. I may say, this is a tragedy. And you may say, what tragedy? This is an opportunity. Look at the juxtaposition, the complete opposites of how we have perceived it. Crisis or opportunity? Well, it depends on your perception. Then we talk about, all right, what do you do with this?
Right.
Our ability to act is based on that perception. So if you believe it's a tragedy and I believe it's an opportunity, my act is going to be develop that into a plan that's going to maximize, whether it's profit or getting on a mountain.
Right.
And then having the will. And I think this is the one that I talk about the most. What saddens me, Yitzhak, is I often see my students come into the classroom and they come in not intentionally and they don't have a will. They don't bring that will, the will to succeed, the will to communicate, the will to learn emotional intelligence. They come with the act of, do I need to know it for the test, and will I get an A? I couldn't care less about their grades, but what's lacking? The will to develop themselves into something. And what I often tell my students, don't focus on that. Focus on becoming. Focus on becoming something, becoming a great communicator, becoming a great husband, becoming a good father. We don't do that, and that's where the will comes in, that we apply the will to what? Well, whatever that is, it's going to be difficult because you don't have a roadmap. When I wrote The Moment That Defines Your Life, I wanted to provide, here are the tools that help you form that roadmap, that help you see things, that's your perception, that helps you to act, that provides the will to want to do better, not just to show up. So all of that I learned from the Stoics, that if you can apply those mental models in the circumstance and temper that with a clear mind, you're going to solve this problem. It may not be immediate, but at least there is a method by which we can approach those circumstances and work out of those jams that cause us enormous stress and anxiety.
Now, when I have a guest like Chuck Garcia, who's a college professor, again, worked at Bloomberg, coaches clients, writes books, and you also are a public speaker.
So I do a lot of that.
So part of the challenge is, how does everyone here wrap their head around everything that you do? Yeah. I understand you're giving a TED Talk.
Indeed, I am.
Could you please just, that's always fascinating. Could you just talk about what's involved, the preparation and some of the mental preparation, and not letting it get to your head, not getting too scared, and yet at the same time, acing such a presentation.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you. And when I think about all those things that you were citing, I don't think of it that way. It's like I think of it, I do one thing. I just have different mechanisms by which I do it. So I communicate. To me, that's teaching. Sometimes I'm on a stage, sometimes I'm speaking, but I do have a friend in Luxembourg who had read A Climb to the Top a while ago. And when The Moment That Defines Your Life came out, I sent him the book. We're just thinking, hey, you know, Pascal is his name. I'm going to give him a shout out. And Pascal read The Moment That Defines Your Life. And he is a lot like me in that he had, in his first career, he was a businessman and he did a bunch of things and he did quite well. And in his second career, he teaches at a university and he's an author as well. And so we have a lot in common. We bonded very well. And he came back to me when he read The Moment That Defines Your Life and said, we in Luxembourg, and it's a small country. There's only 600,000 citizens. Right. But he said, we are forming a TED Talk in November, a TED Day, and we would like you to apply to come and give a TED Talk on The Moment That Defines Your Life. Now, I've trained a lot of people for the TED stage, but I've applied twice, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out. So now it did. But here's the best part. One, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to step on this TED stage. It's a very proud milestone. Mm-hmm. But here's the great part, Yitzhak. We don't have an hour to do this episode. TED Talks are no more than 18 minutes. And I've already developed most of what I'm going to talk about into 14 minutes. How the heck do I put The Moment That Defines Your Life into 14 minutes? But that's the beauty of the TED Talk. The mental model, what I have to talk about, is it clear? Is it concise? And is it purposeful? I got 14 minutes of magic I need to make. How do I prepare for that? Give thoughtful, intentional, and a lot of trial and error in getting people in my world. Hey guys, I'm going to give you 14 minutes of The Moment That Defines Your Life. What's the most important thing? I don't have the luxury of being broad here. Right. I have to find something very specific. I need to ensure that it is instructive, that I'm teaching something that is inspiring, hopefully, and that they'll take something away from it. But it has to be something, there's a call to action. What am I actually trying to do in that 14 minutes? I know I am going to try to inspire, to persuade, and to provoke a change into how people think about this thing called emotional intelligence and stoicism. And I got 14 minutes to do it. What an honor that is. But I think it's such a great task that the TED organization said, you cannot come in here and pontificate for an hour. 18 minutes, right. That's all you got.
Right.
So many of the TED Talks, I trained some for TED, we did it in 12. I'll do mine in 14. This is a very good thing because when we go to college, we take a course for 45 hours. Right. 3 hours in a class, the professor, right. I sat through all these talking. The world does not respond to that very well. So I'm very glad that a few months from now, I'll be in Luxembourg on the TED stage. And what a wonderful opportunity is to bring this work, this emotional intelligence and stoicism to a European audience, but also in the modern world, we just broadcast it to the world. And I'm grateful for that.
And I turn to Mimi, who handles the business class. The tips that Chuck just shared are so incredible for anyone giving a speech.
Yeah.
Yes, he defined it through the lens of a TED Talk, but anyone giving a speech, that the way you really spelled it out, That is a great model. Make sure any speech you're going to, don't get up there and like drone on. Mm. They're not listening.
Right.
But if they follow those steps, they'll have a winning speech.
Yeah. And think about the mental model again. We're always going to come back to that. Ask yourself, not even ask yourself, get people who are your friends who will tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. Give them your 14 minutes and ask them, tell me, guys, is it clear? Is it concise and purposeful? And if the answer is no, start adjusting until you get there. You do not deem your presentation complete until it is all of those three. Because if it's not, keep working it.
Chuck, as you know, when we're on the set, the time flies.
Yes,
we have 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
Something that's near and dear to your heart. Servicing others versus doing for others.
Yeah.
Could you please elaborate?
Yeah. I read a book by the New York Times journalist. His name is David Brooks. And anyone who reads the New York Times knows David Brooks. And he wrote a bunch of books that resonated with me. One of the books he wrote about is called The Second Mountain. And what he talked about, he says, I've met people in my life. There's something different about them. They illuminate. There's something. They just feel different. And what he found is through the course of time, many of us, me, you, have climbed two mountains. The first mountain that we climb is the mountain of self. That mountain is the traditional, I'm going to succeed, I'm going to do my best, it's all about me. But what he said is when he met people who were on this other mountain, the second mountain, that's not servicing the self, the second mountain services others. And I am an embodiment of that metaphor because 9 years ago, I said, I don't need to do this anymore. And when I climbed all of these mountains and I saw these wonderful mountain guides that led me, a mere mortal, not a great athlete, an average athlete with average intelligence, leading me up these mountains, I was inspired by their service to guys like me, unyielding in their desire to ensure my experience. And I became the kind of teacher inspired by those guides. When I came down from a mountain in Alaska called Mount Bona, big, beautiful mountain, way in the middle of nowhere, I said, this is my time. I am now on my second mountain. I'm going to go home, and I am going to spend the rest of my days dedicating my life to the service of others' success. That is my second mountain. And I have to say, what a thrilling adventure it has been. But short of raising my children, I'm going to give a shout out to my college students. Nothing has been more fulfilling than to see them go out, step up, and take their place in the world and succeed. Not just because of the things that I taught them, but just to see them, as I did with my children, to go into the world becoming the person that they were meant to be, even if they don't know exactly what that means, at least what we can do as parents and teachers is provide the tools and hope for the best. And when I see how they're all doing what I've done in the service of their success, there's no higher calling.
Chuck, before we say goodbye, how could people find out more about buying the book and getting in touch with you? Like, hey, he's one great consultant. I need him on my team.
I appreciate that. Yes. Very easy to find me. Remember my name, Chuck Garcia. So you go to chuckgarcia.com and there is a contact tab, big blue button. Hit it, put in your name, your email address, and your phone number, whatever, however you want me to get in touch with you. That is the first way to do it. You can also use the same if you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or ThriftBooks. You can type in, you don't even need to remember the title of my second book called The Moment That Defines Your Life. Just remember Chuck Garcia. Make it one word. Or on the website, on Amazon, Chuck Garcia on Barnes & Noble. The books will come right up. And you can click them on and you can read them. You can listen to them. You can read them on Kindle. There's all kinds of mechanisms.
Chuck, I learned so much from you.
I appreciate the insight. Thank you. Likewise, that's what good friends do. We are all each other's teachers. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of Mind Your Business. You heard Chuck's moment that defined his life, 9/11, his incredible story about 9/11. What's the moment that defined your life? Please share it in the comment section below. And join me on an upcoming episode of Mind Your Business.